views and opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
Greetings once again. Thanks for joining. We are the Code Breakers. I am D.
This is Paradox.
And thank you for tuning in. And as always, we will be discussing all the topics that have happened over the past couple of weeks. And, you know, I guess where do we begin? Because there's so many different things going on out here, and especially pertaining to racism. White supremacy, and as our name says, we're here to decipher code and to offer suggestions and clarity within the system. We want all victims to be independent in their thinking and to always follow the logic, like Mr. Fuller says. So, with that being said, today's date is Tuesday, August 30th, 2016. And Paradox, if you want to kind of go in and jump in with some of the clips or some of the topics, you know, go ahead, sir, and we can go ahead and get this thing kicked off.
All right. The some of the topics we're gonna try to touch on is politics, of course, the 2016 election, propaganda around politics, and maintaining the control of the Americas. We're going to discuss Nate Parker and Nat Turner and the quest for manhood. And I'll read a little bit of our description, which is: this week we will continue to discuss the system of racism, politics, and the impacts on the mind, how the news interprets information for the masses, reviewing how different groups of white people function in politics, etc. So we're going to go to a clip that Mr. Reed's going to play for us, and we're going to start there.
All right, give me just a second as I find the mark. And this is a clip called White It Out 2, Background Check on the White Man Uncovering Hidden Atrocities by the Watchmen Reports. You can find them on YouTube. Let me see, that is 4658.
This book is used in the university curriculum about residential schools. It has been for almost 10 years. And here's a picture of children with active tuberculosis sores. You see the bandages around their head. And the description says they have active, like open tubercular sores, and they're sitting here alongside healthy children. That was the practice described by Dr. Peter Bryce when he said they were being deliberately exposed to diseases. They weren't being quarantined. When you have tuberculosis, you're quarantined. You don't sit with healthy children. This is proof. This is proof of intent to commit genocide, this picture right here. Yet it's in a mainstream text. People look at it, and still to this day they say, there's no proof that we're trying to kill Native people. Well, the proof is right there in that picture. And that practice, which was happening at every residential school across Canada, and it was documented by their own people,
was superior to all others and had to conquer the world, combined with the vested interest of a merchant class that wanted to conquer the world for its own profit, armed with this religion.
This, Senator Crane, is from the United States government.
Do you understand?
I speak your language.
Good. Senator Crane has come here to offer your people a better way of life.
Better than what?
Better than what you have.
I like what I have.
I understand that. But your people live in the Stone Age. We live at the beginning of a great industrial revolution.
He doesn't understand
Chief,
why...
Chief, the United States government is offering you a piece of land of your own.
We have our own land.
No, it's not yours. It's the U.S. government's.
Did they buy it?
No.
Did they trade for it?
It's not like that.
Then how can they own it? He has a point.
If you accept our offer, you won't have to hunt buffalo anymore or roam the prairie. You can depend on your country to take care of you.
You are not my country.
We will give you everything you need if you will just submit to living on a reservation.
We need nothing from you.
Mr. Durant, if we could just...
I'm done, Reverend. Good luck.
I'm a bummer. I don't know. I shouldn't be. I'm a very, lucky guy. I got a lot going for me. I'm healthy. I'm relatively young. I'm white, which thank God for that shit, boy. That is a huge leg up. Are you kidding me? Oh, God, I love being white. I really do. Seriously, if you're not white, you're missing out because this shit is thoroughly good. But let me be clear, by the way. I'm not saying that white people are better. I'm saying that being white is clearly better. Who could even argue? If it was an option, I would re-up every year. Oh, yeah, I'll take white again. Absolutely. I've been enjoying that. I'm going to stick with white. Thank you. I can go to any time. In the past, I don't want to go to the future and find out what happens to white people because we're going to pay hard for this shit. You got to know that. Now, if you're white and you don't admit that it's great, you're an asshole. It is great. And I'm a man. How many advantages could one person have? I'm a white man. You can't even hurt my feelings. What can you really call a white man that really digs deep? Hey, cracker.
Ugh, ruined my day. Boy, shouldn't have called me a cracker. Me back to owning land and people. What a drag.
I mean, everything that we introduce to the world is shitty. Meaning white people. Because I really think that white people are from like another planet. Because we, like, when we came to America, it was so nice. It was just Indians. And they weren't even Indians. We called them that by accident. And we still call them that. We ruined everything here. This was the great... It was just coast to coast, just green and brown and beautiful. And all the humans were just walking around with painted faces, just walking. And they'd be like, "Ooh, that looks yummy." And they just eat from the ground. And then they'd sleep on the grass.
So let me get...
All right, we're back.
Wow. Wow.
I thought you'd find that interesting.
And just so everybody knows, we didn't talk about these clips beforehand and anything. So this is just real time responses to the different clips and things of that nature. So I guess I'm going to kind of take it back to the beginning or what I can remember from the beginning. But was the person that was speaking about the land, was that someone that we would classify as a Native American?
That's correct. Yeah, it was a film.
Okay. What film was that? just want to make sure that we...
That's Hell on Wheels.
Yeah. Oh, that's Hell on Wheels. Okay, cable television cool, series. Cool, about the railroad. Okay.
Yeah.
And I think that, yeah, Scotty brought it to my attention that these would be the same people that exploited the trade, the labor, of course, of people that were so-called more confinement at that particular time and used as cheap labor to build the railroad along with the immigrants from the mainland that they now call China. So, and that's black people, by the way. So just like an extension of the plantation, basically.
And that very first piece was, I think it's a book called Unrepentant, is what it's called. I don't know who wrote it, but it's about, and I don't know how accurate it is either, but it's a genocide in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
50,000 Canadian children murdered, basically assimilating indigenous people.
Well, no, I mean,
it's a white society.
It's accurate because we know what Canada is as of now. We know who the inhabitants of Canada is, and the inhabitants of Canada are not the people that was originally there over 500 years ago. So of course the people that's there had to be replaced by people that classified themselves as white, either whether then they sexed in or sexed out, or I guess they attribute to the genocide. And I guess the gentleman that was speaking, he was a white person, correct?
I believe so.
Yeah, sounded like it anyway. So basically he indicated that they basically this was actually done, and that the proof is basically in the actual source that they was, that they received. And I guess it was proof. And was it a picture? Or
they have some photos in the book. They also have some interviews, because I'm assuming it's a documentary as well. So they actually mm-hmm. interviewed some of the family that's still been dealing. Matter of fact, it reminds me a little bit of what was the book that on the cows that Gus was talking about, where I cannot think of the name of that, where they was breaking down. He was interviewing, I think it was one guy he interviewed that's still alive, that was in prison and was being experimented on. That I think he was doing some of those interviews. And so it kind of reminded me of that, where there's people who are still living and they have family who's went through a process with the French Canadians or whatever they are, white people. And, they're still dealing with the psychological damage and et cetera from it. So they had some of those interviews as well on there. Yeah.
So let me just say this. Is the last part, is that CK?
I don't know what comedian it is. The video just kind of has, it's just blank. It's not showing you a person.
Oh, okay. So it just kind of
like, he sounds like a white guy. It might be CK, actually.
Okay. But no, just to go in order. Let's do that. Let's do that step by step. So what my idea is about the first clip about the doc about the Canadian genocide, it just proves that a lot of what happened here before, or a lot of what we're seeing as far as like how this particular society became as it is at this particular point, was done through mass murder and genocide of a group of people that inhabited this landmass before the people that classified themselves as white came to this particular landmass. So I guess what you can look at this as is basically trying to give an indication to people that are still confused about the reason why people are in the situations that they're in. Now, let me ask you a quick question. When they brought up the mass murder in Canada, did they have like any like facts and figures in any of the information at all?
I didn't get that far into it, but it was pretty detailed. The parts that they had showed on this, it's like a little series that they did, but they went into some detail. I think that 50,000 number is just the name they put on it. I know that number is much higher than that, of course, But one thing they also showed was, remember those images you've seen in Australia, where they show all the indigenous kids, especially the ones that were miscegenated into, and they created that group?
Yeah.
The cover of this book, I believe, has that's literally almost the same image, but they're, you know, people in obviously from the north. You know, just a huge, you know, in front of a school building, you know, maybe 50, 60 kids, if not more.
Yeah, it's just amazing that a lot of times people think of Canada as this oasis of escaping racism, white supremacy, not knowing the history and the mass murder that basically was attributed to that landmass. Also, that is stretched up from what is now called the USA or North America into Canada, also, where they basically, did these mass murders of getting rid of the people that they classified as Indians / Native Americans. And I know a lot of people, do believe that people of that are classified as black are some of the ancestors are part of that Native American heritage. I won't go into detail about that because I'm not as informed. I'm not a scientist when it comes down to genetics. But I would say this. I think that for the most part, the people that were inhabiting this landmass were mass murdered. And I think that they were moved into concentration camps after that took place. That they wanted to get rid of any trace of any group of people that was here, and that they wanted to eliminate that bloodline. And this for a particular reason. The people that inhabited this landmass, you know, you can't indict the people that are already gone. So, you know, if there's no victims that are left, especially when it comes down to mass murder and genocide, then you don't have anybody to answer to. You could just say, hey, we're sorry about what we did, and just keep it moving. Which leads me on to the, the clip where they start to talk about Hell on Wheels, mm-hmm. where he's asking specific questions about property and, you know, having a different understanding about, you know, what takes place and, you know, transactions and, you know, who so-called owns the land or don't own the land. A lot of times us as victims, we get confused about trying to attribute different terms to us when they basically we attribute terms the same way that the white people do, and we think that it actually means the same thing, or we're not really understanding what's taking place. What that particular person that's classified as white was telling, you know, the person that is non-white, take it or leave it. You know, this is what we're giving you. This is the compromise. If you do not take this through the compromise, we would go to mass and extreme violence. You know, the choice is yours. You know, it was a forced negotiation. It wasn't something that they were sitting down at the negotiation table and the person that was speaking was basically there to give up and then, you know, give up some and then give some. He was basically telling them, we're taking this and there's nothing you can do about it, and we're willing to give you this so we won't feel so bad about taking all of this. So that's what I got from that particular clip. What about you?
The reason why I wanted to play that clip probably more than anything was because it puts me in the mindset to even though I know it's a film or whatever, it just puts you in the mindset that they obviously purposely will not show us in the same, you know, have you ever seen like a film or a documentary or even in reading about, say, we'll just say the Mongols, we'll just pick a random group of people and how they paint them as, you know, the European anyway paints them as marauders and murderers, and they go in the villages and kill everything there and rape the women, and they hammer that point in almost. But when it comes to how this land was taken in this time frame that we're in now, I think 1,000 years from now, when they're writing about it and doing films about it, is going to be probably a lot more direct, depending on who's in charge at that time. You know, it could be really, really raw, but they're not really going to show it that way. I think it's hard for people to piece together how this land was systematically taken. You know, I think that's a real difficult thing to process. I know it is for me. I can't speak for everybody else. But for me, I struggle getting a good, clear understanding of, you know, how this land really taken. Because, you know, growing up in America, you're told this story. And I know we talk about it all the time on these different calls. But, I mean, it's impactful because, you know, the first thing you're told is this person, you know, these people came here and it's told in such a very, very light way. The stories are told in a very light way and not in a way where systematically, group by group, over centuries, you just exterminated, you know, moved from group to group.
You know what's so interesting?
And worked your way from sea to shining sea, as you say.
Right. Manifest destiny. Yeah, absolutely. And you know what's so interesting about it is that when you get this kind of this thought process of viewing the world through this white gaze, this type of
through them blue
viewpoint.
Eyes.
Yeah, through the blue eyes. Shout out to Toni Morrison. But this whole deal of trying to view the world through the lens of the oppressor, even though you are the one that suffered the oppression the most. And just the fact that it almost, they had it to the point where they made it feel like, let me give you an example. Lone Ranger. You never felt like the white people were in the wrong or that they were invading in these Westerns, right? When they go all the way back to when they basically first got to the land, who always felt like the person that was doing something incorrect?
The native, the indigenous
people. And these were the people that was home. They're home. They're in their community. They're not being violent. They didn't start this initial attack. You see what I'm saying? Like, they didn't do anything to elicit this kind of response.
These people
came here. You know, that's what's so weird about it. I just want to say this real quick. That's what's so weird about it. We never think of it as these people invading.
Never. No, I agree. I mean, when you said about the Western, I was just thinking about those moments in those Westerns where the indigenous person, who's really a white person in red face, I guess you would say, is circling around the wagons, picking off your favorite characters that they built up in the storyline. The blonde, the little blonde boys and the blonde woman and the strong white man and watching them fight the savages. And it doesn't
But who's the savage?
Look, man, it's so disgusting.
It's ingrained in us.
It's because when you don't know, or if it's not put in a proper context, it does not bother you. I mean, let me go back. It did not bother me. So I grew up watching Westerns and didn't bother me. Didn't think about it. Wasn't even a thought. I mean, it was not. Just understanding how you get assimilated into a society, and then as you discover new things and get things put in context, it's a painful feeling because the people that you love, the people that you grew up with, who are, you know, 30 years older than you, 40 years, 50 years older than you, love those films, the ones that I knew, never made it make any sense as if it was just normal. It was entertainment. Nothing in a sense, no historical conversations, unfortunately. It literally was entertainment. And And the sickening part about it is that it was showing how they always, I think they say what, how the West was won.
Yeah.
You know, it's, and I mean, it's hammered in though. Having that gun, having that rifle, I mean, it makes you fall in love with rifles. You know, even though you have some people who I've seen through my lifetime who identify with Indian people, and I'm talking about white folks who are pretending to be Indians to get benefits from the tribes that are still around. I'm not to go down that road either, but at this point, but just watching the assimilation process, and the reason why I wanted to play the clip more so than that was because when people are talking about treaties, when people are talking about people following rules, people are talking about building empires within an empire, people are talking about this stuff. In my opinion, I'm not sure what they're really talking about, because we have overwhelming evidence historically in this nation that explains to you what it means to be under a ruling power called white supremacy. The same, if we go to the Congo, and we had discussed this earlier, going to the Congo and looking at the history, looking at how they were structured, looking at how it was set up, looking at the after effects of understanding economics and resources. And just because you think you have a nation and you think you even have your own resources, it's not that simple. Just the complexities of it outside of something, even though globally speaking, the Europeans for the most part has the reins of this planet. You have nations, and the reason why I want to use our homeland as far as the continent of Africa, but just looking at certain nations there and starting to just break them down, study them, understand their civil wars that came about, understanding the different groups, the different fractions that happened, understanding the governments that are there now, how many of them are tied, if not all are tied to Europeans, just that process. To get a really clear understanding of what it means to be a part of an empire, and also what it means that when the empire lets you become independent, allows you more space. Now, the same in Africa, just to stay on the continent for a minute, and looking at the African American in this country and where we're getting more space, I know it does cause some confusion. The Code Breakers, our attempt really is for me individually, Paradox, to get less confused, because, you know, and hopefully that may lend some assistance to others who listen to the program, but it's more or less for me to try to get more knowledge, more understanding, interacting with people online and in other ways, just to learn more about what's going on the planet, because getting to our children, our nieces, nephews, our sons and daughters, just even getting this information to them, because if they're not getting homeschooled, if they're not getting counter information, they're getting hit pretty much with the same stuff that that many of us got hit with growing up. So it is vital, I think, to understand the treatment of the indigenous people here, the treatment of how the continent was colonized and then set up to put those people in charge of their own areas, but still have direct connections up to the power dynamic in Europe and in America, and just trying to get an understanding of as their power has grown, how they can control and manage information, how they can control and manage resources, and how they can control and manage finances. And I think that a lot of times people here, and the people that I watch online and watch on television, et cetera, and people that I read about, that seems to be missing. That information about what it means to be a white person on this planet, what it means to spend the last 5 or 6 centuries colonizing the planet, and then how the planet, for the most part, is still using their system. The last time I checked, even the most anti-nation, which I will go with North Korea off the top of my head,
that's a good one,
still are being sanctioned, still are being pressured.
Mm-hmm.
They have a government, They have a military. Right. See, this is the thing. They have a military. Supposedly, I think even the Million Man Army.
Largest standing army. The largest.
They supposedly still. They supposedly have nuclear, biological, and chemical warfare. They supposedly have some of the smartest scientists and engineers on the planet.
Mm.
And even with their own nation, they went to war. They got checked. They fought. They died. They're still doing things. They're still being controlled. They're still understanding. They're trying to assert power. And we can go on a list of countries. That's just to choose. That's just to pick one. So when I pull all the way back to America, and you looking at the plight of the black man and the black woman and the black child, trying to get an understanding of, you know, where are we under the system of racism? And how are we being manipulated? How are we being used? And are we, how do you explain, how do we explain to ourselves what situation are we really in? And be very, very, one of our key things is, you know, people have to try to be as honest as possible when it comes to the information. Live your life, do what you do. But when it comes to information, do your best to get things in a proper context. And the only reason why I make that point about that, as I look into the IMF, the World Banks, globalization, the United Nations, specifically, and one thing that you really hammer in that people haven't heard a lot of on the program so far is understanding World War II. And even going back a little bit in understanding the invention of race and the invention of whiteness. And also blacks accepting race. The world accepting race. And understanding what that means from a mainstream perspective. And also trying to get an understanding of indigenous groups that are still on the planet and what they think of themselves. How they still interpret the universe. And just understanding that tying in religion, specifically Christianity and Islam off the top of my head, and looking at how they've impacted indigenous cultures, how they've impacted ancient belief systems, and just the assimilation process to pull people out of that. And that clip, just that clip for maybe 2 or 3 minutes, really reminds me of, you know, what does it mean to be white? Understanding white supremacy. And when we're talking about being dominant, respecting the dominance or hating the dominance, whatever you need to get your mind right to understand what it means to be a dominant power group, what it means to do whatever they have to do. And we can caveat it with, you know, they're scared. We can use whatever language we want to use to make ourselves function and think a certain way. And I understand that. But really understanding what it means to control and manage a global system, because we have so much historical data from the British Empire and what they were able to do and how they were able to colonize and looking at George Washington and those guys and how they went through a process of trying to break free. But and then looking at the Nazi Germany and just looking at slavery and how they use whiteness and being able to collectively come together and oppress the planet. I just don't. It's strange to me to know that information at this point. Don't have all the information, right? Mm-hmm. But just to know a little bit of information about white supremacy. And then someone telling me, non-white doesn't really matter, about what we gonna do. Because I'm very clear on 5 centuries, no savior. So let's leave that where it's at, right? 5 centuries and no savior. 15 more centuries before that and no savior, right? You know, no God of Abraham, but I'm gonna leave that alone for a second. But right. But the key here is understanding that human beings are oppressing people. They're oppressing indigenous people. They're destroying indigenous people's land and they're controlling the mind. So not to go too much on a tangent, but just trying to get an understanding of that and not getting it kind of spooky, not getting it religious, not getting it there's other factors running and, you know, hidden away, but really getting, really understanding how these people systematically, scientifically, ruthlessly created this system. And that's one of, I think, of our main points. that I want to continue to hammer in as long as I can. Not to go too much on a rant.
No. That was good information. And what I would like to do is, we are about being accurate as much as possible, and I made a statement which was incorrect. I'd like to go over what I think are the largest. I just had to recheck it, and just got some assistance from Mr. Reed on this. But, yes, I just wanted to go over the largest armies to kind of give it a little context. And these are the top 10. I just want to make sure, and anybody that want to cross-reference it, please, be free to do so. But this is coming from the World Atlas website. Number one is China, largest standing army. So we was wrong, but I guess the same point applies to China also. But China is right now active military working 2,333,000. Right now. The next in line is the HQ, the United States, 1,492,200. The next one, which surprised me, it says that is India. India has 1,325,000 people in their standing army. And the fourth one is North Korea, which is 1,190,000. And then there is a significant drop. It drops down. I'm just going to go by the top five. I don't need to go any further than that. The fifth one is Russia, Mother Russia. And you can tell that they have taken a hit, especially from the 80s and the Cold War days. They are now just working at 845,000. So, how the mighty Russia has basically fallen and pretty much gone bankrupt due to their military. But that is the top five according to the World Atlas. Like I said, if people have more information to give per that reference, we'd be more than happy to take any suggestions, any kind of information. But I just wanted to make sure that we're giving out the most accurate information as possible, because we're not here to cause confusion. We're not here to have big egos and say that we know everything. It's clear that we do not. And just to kind of reiterate about your point about being in an empire and being under a group that have dominated the globe per violence. I guess this will lead into the further end of the program, but I want to get into C.K. Lewis and his whole description about whiteness, mm-hmm. and where he was basically going on about how it feels to be white, what it means to be white. He spoke from a white male perspective. But I do not want to just exclude that and be like, this is the only group that basically enjoy the power of whiteness. Of course, we know that white women can enforce racism at extreme measures. We have a modern day example of it, which is Hillary Clinton. And then we also have a previous predecessor to Hillary Clinton, and I think she has been a recipient of the Margaret Sanger Award. And these are not white males, these are white women. So, this is not only a system that is enjoyed by the white male counterpart. This is a white racist family. When you look at white people, you have to look at them as white woman, white man, white children. It is a cohesive group. And the people that fall into that classification, if they do have the ability to practice racism, as Mr. Fuller say, most likely they are doing it. So, so when he was basically describing his whole deal about, what it means to be white, and, we're going to pay in the end. It's almost like that nervous laughter. You can hear that nervous laughter in there when they was basically talking about some of the different things. You can hear some of the people laughing and kind of being nervous about some of the things that they were talking about. So I think that it was very, very honest. I agree wholeheartedly what he said. I didn't have no problems at all. In fact, I did have a chuckle, because it's always great when white people are being honest. We don't need to be sensitive about when white people are being honest with us. And I think that there has been a pattern of behavior that wants to silence people that speak like he does, openly like that, where they're saying that this so-called, I guess you would say, politically incorrect. But I don't think he said anything that was not true. What did you think about the clips with C.K. Lewis? And I did confirm that was C.K. Lewis.
No, I'm with you on that. It sounded pretty honest to me. So it speaks for itself. I don't need to do too much comment on that. I mean, it's pretty straightforward about it, because I mean the crowd was laughing. If that was a real crowd that was there.
Oh no, it was a comment. Yeah, it was a real crowd. They laughed. It was nervous laughter, by the way. He was a white person speaking to white people about.
I mean, at the end of the day, I think people like Donald Trump and people of his ilk that's coming out now more and more, they prefer to live. A lot of them want to be that way, open, right, direct, and straight up. But again, they have to stay codified to avoid war, I think, with the subjugated people. But Mr. Reed, I know he has to do a break in a minute here. He's gonna play maybe that first clip or two. And we can kind of work off of that going forward. I don't want to stay on that first clip too much longer.
All right. That's it. Did you want to cue up the clip? Whenever you guys are ready, we can get into it. That's fine.
I think he might be playing it, but I'm not sure if it's picking up.
You don't hear it?
Mm-mm. I do not. They just sent me a message.
All right, well, Sue, we can keep it. We can keep it flowing. That's perfectly fine. But yeah, like let's kind of go into detail about some of the different vestiges of white supremacy. And when we talk about some of the subjugation that's happening, that we can see as far as like us not being honest about what is going on globally and in dealing with this system. So I think he's back. So yeah, Mr. Reed, if you want to, you can go ahead and cue up the clips. That's fine.
Yeah, I don't know what order, because when I downloaded them, they are in a different order. So
that's fine. I mean, they're all around us. It's all politics.
Okay,
stuff, so it's
I can
all around
I can just
thing.
Name it. Chris Hayes, North Carolina's ad, about 2:40 clip. You want me to run with it?
Yeah,
that worked.
Thing one tonight, North Carolina was once a reliably red state, but now Republicans there are worried they're facing what could be their worst election year in decades. Among the potentially vulnerable, two-time incumbent Republican Senator Richard Burr. Last time he was up for re-election, he won by 12 points. Now, latest polling shows him with just a 3-point advantage over his Democratic opponent, Deborah Ross. This week, both Ross and Burr released their first television ads at the fall Senate race. Burr's ad features African-American pastor Kirby Jones, who runs a center in Raleigh that helps kids from low-income families.
I'm Richard Burr, and I approve this message.
I trust and believe in Richard Burr. Our organization has as its mission to narrow the education gap in math, science, and technology for at-risk and economically disadvantaged children. Richard has done a great deal to help the children and their families get on a path and a trajectory that leads to academic success and life success. He is genuinely interested in our community, in our children. Thank you, Richard Burr, for helping the families and children of North Carolina.
Now, I will say, that is a really effective ad. It's running a state whose population is 22% African American in the year of Trump, and Burr's trying to separate himself from them. There's just one sort of really awkward issue with it. And that's thing two, which I'll show you in 60 seconds. So Republican Senator Richard Burr, North Carolina, released a really powerful ad this week featuring local pastor Kirby Jones praising Burr's support of Jones' work with low-income kids in the state. And the ad features these very adorable school children looking very studious. And there's just one problem. The kids are not affiliated with any kind of education program in North Carolina because they come from here, Getty's iStock website. So, okay, that happens in political ads, but here's the problem, as Talking Points memo discovered. Two clips of stock footage featured in Burr's ad are tagged as suitable for stories about Africa. For instance, this image from the Burr ad can be found on iStock labeled as African teacher and schoolgirls, but it is tagged with keywords including Africa, African ethnicity, and non-U.S. location. While this image, featured in the Burr ad, which struck me at the time as uniforms I hadn't seen, is called Group of School Children Drawing on iStack, and is tagged with the keywords Africa, South African culture, and non-U.S. location. As Doug McAuliffe, the maker of Richard Burr's ad, told TPM, the ad company used stock video because it was not able to shoot B-roll of students in Pastor Kirby's program. According to McAuliffe, he was sensitive about ensuring that Kirby's group's tax-exempt status was not put in jeopardy by being part of a political ad. So, a good reason to use stock video. Someone just chose or searched very poorly.
Yeah, so am I back on?
Yeah. Yes, sir. We hear you. Go ahead.
Yeah, that was just some politician, and I don't know if Mr. Reed know about the guy, but that's some politician down in North Carolina.
He's the senator over the district that I live in. Mm-hmm. He's assigned to this particular district. I did not see that ad. But I live in a area that is predominantly white. And the history of this area is actually, you know, ties into a whole bunch of stuff y'all already been talking about, but that would take another program to describe that history. But I would again say reading is very important, and your sources are very important, and you really have to do some digging. But I see a lot of racism being practiced there. MSNBC. Is solidly in the corner, and Chris Hayes solidly in the corner of the racist Hillary Clinton. Here in North Carolina, I think Trump may take North Carolina. Wow. But if he's federal, but I do expect Republicans to get taken out of office here in North Carolina, and not because black people turn out in large numbers to vote for Hillary Clinton, but because they made enemies in the gay community, you know, and so they've done a lot of things for people to be mad about. But Richard Burr, I don't really hear a whole lot from him. I've been getting mailings and whatnot, but they not going to run that ad around here. So they're going to target that audience. So I figure it's probably a lot of black people classified as black that particular ad probably ran in here in North Carolina. But he is the quote unquote senator. I never call these people my senator, my congressman. No, they are appointed to those positions, and I just live in this district that they created.
He's Republican, right?
Yes, he is.
Mm-hmm. And that was a black pastor, I believe, that they were that was doing the talking, if I'm not mistaken. So I always think that the black pastors and politics just is a strange combination in my mind.
Strange bedfellows is what that is, most likely. You know, we being that we're not really in North Carolina and we're not really there on the ground. Let me ask you a quick question, Mr. Reed. Do the pastors or the clergy there in the North Carolina, just in the state, because I know there's another clip that we have that's pertaining to Reverend Barber, which I think he's out of North Carolina too, right? Is that correct?
Yes, Reverend Barber is the head of the NAACP, the state. He's the state president of the NAACP, but right. He is a reverend.
He has right. That clip. He can play it next if you want him to. He should see it on there.
Yeah, let's just cue up that clip and then we can kind of go into
Is it titled MSNBC Race?
Black Pastor. Yeah, that's the one.
I don't think it say pastor, but yeah, PST. That's short for pastor. Yeah, okay.
African-American community, the minority community in general, is there any concern that they're taking the vote for granted?
Well, you know, that's a great question, Allie, because the reality is African African Americans have had to be among the most sophisticated voters. The reality is we've had to challenge both parties, and that has been our history. But when you look at the preponderance of the evidence, particularly since the establishment of the White Southern Strategy and the continuing incarnation of it, what you can see is that the Republican Party in general has been more of an obstructionist. Who has led the effort to suppress the vote? They have. Who has tried to fight to restore the Voting Rights Act and to fight against voter suppression, for instance? It has been the Democratic Party. Now, no party is perfect, and all people in America know that. And that is why not only do you vote for people, but you have to push them. But the preponderance of the evidence is that the Republican Party, and particularly this extreme element that Trump is representing, have been the chief obstructionists to advancement in civil rights, advancements in voting rights, advancements in health care, advancements in living wages, advancement in criminal justice reform. And for the most part, African Americans and the Democratic Party have tried to work in that regard. Let me say this. What he in essence is saying is that African Americans are gullible, which is a deep insult, especially to black women, because the highest voting ethnic group in this country are black women. So what Trump is saying, it's really paternalistic, and it's a subtle racism, and not so subtle racism, is that we are somehow gullible. And think about where he began saying what he's saying to mostly all white audiences in the South. He wasn't talking to African Americans, no reaching out. He was engaging in an old type of dog whistle politics in the 21st century.
Do you get any sense that members in your community still have an open mind, that they're, you know, that their vote is still malleable, they're not quite certain where they're going, or do you think around you that minds are made up? In other words, for Hillary Clinton to lose the African-American vote, it would have to be something quite significant that Donald Trump isn't necessarily going to make inroads in that community.
Well, black people are open-minded to policy, as we always have had to be. Even when we voted for Democrats, have down through history, it was always based on policy and not just personality. So black people are open to this. Where do you stand on fully funding public education and ending resegregation and high poverty schools? What kind of policies do you support that will engage in bring economic justice, that will lift the poor out of poverty through living wages? Where do you stand on health care? Do you know all over this country, the governors, for instance, and the legislatures that are blocking, for instance, Medicaid reform, are doing it in the states where 6 out of 10 black folk live? They're hurting African Americans, but they're also hurting whites, because in my state, for instance, 346,000 of the people who would benefit from Medicaid expansion are white. It's an old play. There's an attempt to split black and white people. So what we look at is policy. Where are you on criminal justice reform? Where are you on immigration rights? Where are you on protecting and expanding the voting rights? Ask Donald Trump, where is he on the restoration of the Voting Rights Act in a period of time where we have seen the worst attacks on voting rights since Jim Crow? Mm-hmm. That's what African Americans look at, not just party, but policy. Because see, racism is not so much, systemic racism is not what's in your heart, but what's in the heart of your policies. Mm-hmm. And we look at the preponderance of the evidence, and that's how we make a judgment. And that's why African Americans have tended to support our Democrats, particularly since the 60s, mm-hmm. 68s and on, because of the policies. And Donald Trump is wrong on policy.
Reverend William Barber, it's always a thoughtful conversation you bring to the broadcast. Thank you very much. It's good to see you.
Thank you so much.
What are your thoughts?
Well, I guess from what it kind of go back to what my concern is, and normally I want to make sure that I'm not trying to I want to be careful, because I think that Reverend Barber is someone that feels I don't know how he feels, but it comes across that he is very concerned about the black community, and specifically in the, you know, in North Carolina. I think that tends to be something that he's very, very you know, cognizant of. And also, it appears that he is a staunch member of the Democratic Party, so he is doing everything in his power to ensure that Trump is not elected as the president elect, and that he doesn't take North Carolina in particular, because I think that North Carolina is up for grabs, like Mr. Scotty Reed has reiterated before we played this particular clip. But I just had a concern, because it looks like when white people want to move or influence a large amount of people that are classified as black, they tend to speak with people that are part of the clergy. This tends to be something that is used very strategically. I don't think that it's only, and I know he didn't really reiterate this, but I don't think this is only something that is used as a political strategy or a Southern strategy. I think this is across the board, if I'm not mistaken. Reverend Al has a program on MSNBC, and he's a person that is a born and raised New Yorker, and he's used in the same way as the victim of racism, Reverend Barber. So I just had a concern, because it appears that to motivate people that they will get someone in front of us, is almost like nothing has really changed over 50 years, that we still, the most trusted or the most poignant person when it comes down to politics that is speaking, or that are speaking on behalf of black people as a whole, are clergymen. Is that the same thing that you get out of this, or am I kind of like going off the rails here?
I'm not sure. I mean, you know, the television tells me that that's the case. The more I try to get an understanding of racism and kind of get a, you know, looking at how white people, how they operate their system, you know, outside looking in a weird way, even though we're a part of it. Apparently, that's a part of it. So pastors seem to be a huge deal. I know that there's other groups as well that they need to interact with, but I do know pastors is one of the ones that you really do hear about, probably more so than anything. Even if anything that happens in the so-called black community, they have bring other people in, but one of the key people that has to be there is the black Christian pastor.
I think I can help you be less confused on that. They are natural leaders in the black community. This has always been for centuries here in what they call America. Behind the enemy lines of USA Inc. So, because there has always been places that black folks have went to organize. So that's throughout the centuries of black churches, and therefore black pastors have always been at the center of activity, whether that's religious activity, whether that's political activity, even economic or business activity. A lot of it was ran through the church until you get up into the 1950s, and you then had the Nation of Islam, which, by the way, we could classify that as a church. And you know, they have clergy, so agreed, to speak. So I just think that that's something that's always been in place, and so they always naturally going to go to those people, because, you know, then they're using Mr. Barber specifically, because not only is he clergy, and I don't know how large of a church he has, but not only is he clergy, but he's head of the state chapter, the state NAACP, which has the largest membership of black people to any state. So he carries a lot of influence, so that's why he's being showcased right now. So I'm hoping that I'm shedding some quote-unquote light on why we see pastors often showcased. And so I just think throughout history and from what I've seen in my experiences is that they are usually always at the center of that type of activity in the community for centuries.
I see. I think that you know, like we are very, very aware of the pull of the clergy. You know, me and Paradox are people that are raised in the Black church, specifically, and we know, like I said, we know the pull that it has. I am just of the so this is where I get into my opinion on the matter. I think that it's problematic that they have used the clergy to be the primary voice for all Black people, because at the end of the day, you know, I don't think of it as a political, or shouldn't be a political title. I could be incorrect. I don't know of any politicians. Well, no, let me not say that. I know that there may be, depending on your area, white politicians that do use the white clergy also, so that may not be as accurate.
Yeah, that's pretty big on, you heard of Ralph Reed. He ran an organization back in the 80s. Donald Trump has been pandering to the religious right and trying to get their vote. So, you know, I'm trying to think of some of the names. Jerry Farwell's and all of them, they still active.
Yeah.
Pat Roberts, all of them.
Yeah, the 700 Club. Yeah, that was a political vehicle too. True. They were part of that whole religious right. Yep. So no, I guess it's always been used. I guess it's just another part of the system that is used to kind of, you know, cater influence. So it's basically one of those deals that is one of those things that we got to pretty much delve into and make sure that we are kind of like speaking to, you know, when somebody may be compromised. Mr. Reed, you know, you're around in that area, and you know Reverend Barber.
Yes,
way more than me and Paradox would.
I have nothing negative to say about the man. I may not agree with some of his political alignments as of recently, but I have a lot of respect for the man. He has the ability to mobilize tens of thousands of people. Moral Mondays became known nationwide. They were covering that, and this was out of political season, and so he was organizing. He impresses me. Anybody that can get white people to mobilize for his cause, you got some skill going on there, and he has been doing that, man. They've been occupying the halls of not Congress, but you know, the state house and stuff. So the man absolutely is about his work and working to implement justice. But I just, you know, there's been some criticism of him because of him knowing, and that was evident in his DNC speech, that Hillary Clinton is not a moral person either. Just like Donald Trump, quote unquote, moral, since he represents the cloth. And he said that in his speech, she's working towards these moral positions. So that tells me he knows she's not a moral person. But for whatever reason, he decided to allow them to he accepted the invitation to come speak and therefore endorse her. I wouldn't say he's given her a ringing endorsement. I haven't seen him on the news or any ads telling Black people to vote for Hillary Clinton. He's mostly just spoken out against Trump. But again, these are white people practicing deception on us. He's a pawn. He may not even, you know, know that he's being used in that fashion. I don't know him personally, but just from the outside looking in, the man believes in justice, and he puts in work in his state towards justice. I just cannot reconcile his no matter how flimsy it was, but his or underwhelming it was, but his endorsement of a person like Hillary Clinton.
All right. Do you want to run the next couple of clips, or do you want to go to break?
We could just take a short 30-second break, and you want me to play the Chris Hayes Trump immigration, or let me see, what is this one?
Chris Hayes, Trump and Clinton.
Alternative right part to Trump. Okay, I got the Clinton clip. Okay, we'll take a break and come back to that. Did y'all want to give out the phone numbers for later as we hit the second half?
Yes, sir. So you can call in at 1-641-715-3660, extension 549032 pound. Hit star 6 and 1 to comment on the air. This is the Code Breakers.
You are listening to Code Breakers on Black Talk Radio Network, new black media for the new millennium.
We'll have to deal with whatever they say on air, and it ends up in a very difficult situation.
Yeah, you also had a great cash day, which I should note, which is that Trump today refusing to renounce his New Hampshire campaign advisor, who has called for Hillary Clinton to be shot.
Repeatedly. And
repeatedly.
By the way, this is a perfect example, okay? He said these remarks in July. They got a ton of coverage. Trump's campaign said he does not agree with those remarks, right? He's since said them again. You know, he was investigated by the Secret Service and said them again this month. Trump was asked today by a New Hampshire reporter about this, and he just said, well, I don't know about those remarks. I haven't heard them, which is, first of all, implausible. But second of all, but he's a great guy. What a great advice. I'm getting such good advice from my veterans. He knows the military like no one else. And I just add, by the way, this is a little break in here. Someone from the Trump campaign reached out to me on background, a little upset, because our headline says Donald Trump defends advisor who called for executing Hillary, because he didn't specifically defend the execution.
Right.
But I'd say it's a bit of a character defense.
Right.
This is
right.
your advisor, and you're
right.
saying how great he is.
Julia Yaffe and Benji. Benji, hang with me, Julia Yaffe. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
All right. Well, we're back. This is the Code Breakers. DC, you have any comments on that clip?
No, I don't really have any comments on that clip. I just... that, I mean, it says it all. I mean, what say you on that?
It just says a lot. I mean, that's you know, he's been saying things like that, and I just think to myself, this is really happening. I mean, like, we finally have, a lot of evidence. I think everyone should really be paying attention right now, just because to have the ability to say these things and, you know, no one is obviously being brought up on charges, no one is being investigated. These things are allowed, and as a white male, they can be said, you know, and you can even have the guy, I think, I don't know if he was a governor or whatever, up in Maine somewhere up there. I think that's where he's at. Who Republican guy got elected and can really do anything, you know, can really say anything. These are the people who are passing laws. These are the people who are approving laws, who are signing off laws, who can pardon people, who can lock up, who can mistreat, who has all the connections, all the power. And when you hear stuff like this, I mean, to me, it's just an indication of the system that we're living in.
Right.
Like, you know, if you don't pay attention to it, it is so easy to just miss all of it, of course. But as you start to dig in and start to read and look at more and more information, it's really in your face. And we're seeing it more so now. I'm not sure if it's because you have more poor white people who are struggling in the global economy. I don't know if that's one part of it. I don't know if people are maybe losing their religion. Things are more secular. So people, you know, I'm not really sure what's causing the trigger. It could be what I would call the Obama effect. I'm not sure if by seeing black people in the White House has caused some trigger to where you have a group of white people who just cannot contain themselves anymore. And so you're really starting to see what it means to be white, what it looks like when you don't really have a real check in play. You check yourselves, And when you as a group, if enough people come together, reason why I think David Duke, I think, is running for senator. David Duke is running for senator somewhere, Mississippi, Alabama, I don't know, wherever he's at. And the reason why he feels emboldened, the reason why, I think we're going to play some clips from what they now call in the alt-right, which is the white supremacist group, white nationalist group. They have different terms. But I think it starts to get into these millions and millions and millions of white people in Europe. And I was telling you before about the British dude down in Mississippi introducing Trump. But looking at Europe, looking at them, I think they call it, which is kind of strange, they call it nativism, where the supposedly original people or the white people, either in America or Canada or Europe,
right.
feel whatever that word they use, where as people of color are coming in. I mean, we're not even talking about sub-Saharan African people, heavily melanated or Sudanese people. We're talking about people from Syria who, if I'm not mistaken, isn't that where they come from? You know, I guess. So, I mean, they're even being concerned about any type of person who they don't classify as white moving into their areas too fast. Things are changing too fast. And you start to get a group of white people who feel, I guess they say disenfranchised, and or feel like you have Indians, Chinese people coming into the countries, running things, taking control of things, managing different things, and they start to feel a certain way, and they want to uprise. I think it's more of a concern than a lot of us are making it. I think if you study white people, and the more I really look at what they're doing as a group, I don't think it takes many of them to overthrow anything. And so you may have a quote-unquote good group of white people who protect all the non-whites on the planet. Like, we're going to mistreat you, but we're going to treat you a certain kind of way. But there's this other group of white people who want to put you in ovens, who want to exterminate you, lynch you, and hang you, and talk crazy right in your face, have no cut cards, as they say. So if that group or those groups start to come together and feel like something has changed in the country, we feel like we're getting a little bit more power, we're able to kind of start to say what we want to say and maybe do what we want to do, you may start to get the things that you get. Now, again, you always have to be concerned about, are we being played out? So I'm always cautious when I make those statements, because I'm not totally clear about what's really going on. Because the media starts to show you the militias, the white militias. The media starts to show you black folks getting killed by cops. The media starts to show you, what is it called, the White Lives Matter is a supremacist group now that's out there.
Yeah, and that so goes when with you, the propaganda machine.
Right,
yeah.
Propaganda machine. So when you start to see these things visually, I don't know if they're trying to create a story for me that's not real, or is this a very real thing? And should black people specifically be very concerned about being killed to calm white people? Being, you know, what is it, bloodletting, whatever they call it? Mm-hmm. You know, are we being abused? Are we Is it
purge?
Purging? Are white people making it clear that no, we're all still white. We're all still on the same team. We're all still together, and regardless, you know, who has what position and what title, you know, we will mistreat these people to the maximum to maintain whiteness. Again, I don't know how that works, and the reason why I'm making a point about that is the Tea Party. What they call in the Tea Party over the last, I think, decade or so, as that group has been growing, as white people, like I said before, feel like they're not getting what they should be getting out of the system monetarily, I don't know, as the years go by, that group gets bigger, that group mobilizes, that group, I think there's one old white lady called it the sleeping giant or something, she said some years ago. And so for me, it's more of a caution. See, you got people who are non-white who are really focused on economics, who are really focused on religion. And they don't understand that they're in a white empire, a group of people that has no problem, the last time I checked, taking out entire groups of people. They have no problem doing that. And so if those are the same people that's here on the planet today, if we're talking about the same people, then, you know, what should we be focused on? We all got to eat. We all got to survive, and we all got to figure it out. And it's a tough situation that we're in because their military is strong, and they're going to have non-whites, you know, in places, you know, even if you want to say the martial law thing, I think, and not to get too far off the subject, but even in Chicago, I was looking at an article about, and I think Tariq brought it up. What was it about, was it Chicago? Was it a former governor back in 2013 that wanted to lock up 18,000, they want to do a sweep and lock up 18,000 gang members in Chicago a few years ago? 18,000 people.
18,000 people. I'm not really sure on that as far as like that there's information.
There's a news article on I think it's, I don't know if it's on abcnews.com.
No, you definitely could be right. I mean, Chicago has a whole lot going on, especially with different things, especially with the whole deal with crime and different, you know, black sites and things of that nature. Now, I do know that there were black sites that were up and running out in Chicago. That was something that was going on there in the city of Chicago.
Yeah, his name is...
it's always scapegoated also.
It was in Chicago Magazine is one article, but Chicago Tribune too, but his name is Mark Kirk. Wanted to arrest 18,000 gang members. I believe he was a senator.
Okay.
And that was his plan to combat gang, was to throw them all in jail. And so he put together, or attempted to put together a plan to start that process. And so I was just looking at where you have, not, I don't want to read the article right now, but just to say, you have white people in charge, and probably non-whites as well, in powerful positions in this country specifically, or even worldwide. And what I think we're missing is that an article like this, or even when we were talking about back after World War II, I think it was is it Truman? Just to tie it into that, but even with Truman, with the it was
Roosevelt. Truman was after Roosevelt during World War II.
Yeah, but Truman wanted to do the jobs bill.
Mm-hmm.
And even when we were talking about that, how these people make big decisions that impact everybody. And understanding that power dynamic was my whole point. Is for the government to sign some things off and create an entire middle class of people to invent, you know, employment for 80, 90 million people with the signature of a pen.
Mm-hmm.
And then we look at places on this. We look at rural areas that are struggling due to outsourcing and et cetera. We're looking at the guns being moved around in this country and drugs, et cetera. We're talking about it, but systematically, it's on purpose. Systematically, it's being done. It's not in my mind, people choosing necessarily to do these things. You know, these environments are set up, meaning that you can end the mistreatment. Is my whole point. You know, if you can make a decision, you know, to lock up 20,000 people, which is insanity, if you can make a decision to lock that, do a sweep to lock up that many number of people, or to go into places and what they would call gentrifying, obviously, but to go into places and solve the problems by pushing everybody out and rebuilding an area, reinvesting hundreds of million dollars, if not billions of dollars, into an area, to be able to do all of those things, it shows me. That you can solve these problems. It shows me that white supremacy is a real thing just because of that. Just because we've seen too many great things that this nation has developed. Right?
Absolutely. And I think that what I would like to do at this juncture is kind of like reiterate the point that I know that it may come across that you know, we're kind of reading off the so-called list of things that you know the the empire or the white supremacists have done and continue to do with things of that nature. And one of the things that we were trying to do is to be honest, number one, and number two, kind of give you a realistic look at what is taking place and what is happening. I like to read a quote. I know you was probably going to get into it a little bit later, but it looked like Matt Kirk. This is a direct quote on about the 18,000 people, just to kind of give people a little bit more clarity on what this gentleman was doing or what he was all about. My top priority is to arrest the gangster disciple gang, which is 18,000 people. I would like to amass pickup of them and put them all in Thompson Correctional Facility, says Kirk. I will be proposing this to the assembled federal law enforcement. This is the ATF, this is the DEA, this is the FBI. Now, what's the reason or why do we think that this is an actual issue or this is an actual problem? Number one, just the fact that someone can make a statement and say, my top priority is to arrest the gangster disciple gang. Now, if I'm not mistaken, the gangster disciple gang is primarily people that are classified as black. Now, I don't think that that's all the gang members, of course, but I would say the overwhelming majority, yes.
Yeah.
Of that group or that people
organization
that is attributed to the gangster disciples, otherwise known as the GDs, are people classified as black. So this person is basically already put in place, and I would say that not all, but most would most likely be black males. He is already basically attributed that he has declared war on these 18,000 people. Now, I don't know if he has a running list of the membership of the gangster disciples. So I would imagine that if you are even speaking, related, and you fit the so-called description of someone that is in contact or in multiple contact with the group known as the Gangster Disciples, that you would basically be under investigation by the ATF, DEA, and FBI per this quote. Now, I don't know what they have done to, you know, start this process, but this was done in 2013. And, of course, we're in 2016, and, of course, we know that there are still problems ongoing in Chicago. But this is just to kind of give you the listeners... the listeners about the idea of what the system is and how it works. Hopefully, what we're trying to do in a nutshell, and I don't want this to be lost on anyone, is we want people to realistically look at this system. Look at the power dynamic between the people that are classified as black and the people that are classified as white. And to combat this system individually, to make your own decisions, and to use logic. We are, as a group, way too confused. And I make that statement based off just our general conflict with each other. We make statements all the time about what we want to do, what we're going to do, things that we don't have any control over, and the evidence just shows it. We are a group that is right with frustration. We don't hold power globally. We are allowed to do certain things, which causes a little bit of confusion, but I don't think that there's that much confusion when it comes down to it, because I know per just dealing with people that are classified as black and being a person that's classified as black, I do understand the dynamic of what we understand in the system that we're living in. So I just wanted to kind of give that caveat before we continue. If you want to kind of go through some more clips, we can go through some more clips. But thanks for bringing that up to my attention. Yeah, that was very informative. Matt Kirk, Matt Kirk, ladies and gentlemen, Matt Kirk. Mark Kirk. Yeah, so Senator.
All right.
Illinois.
And so Scott, I just sent you another email. Could you when you get a minute, I'm gonna make a couple of comments on something else, but if you can play those for us, I appreciate it. But the clips that are coming up, it's really about this whole white supremacist or alt-right.
Yeah, I think you already sent me that clip.
It's like two or three parts.
Okay. Let me see. These look like they're labeled the same one. Okay, Trump race, alt race. Okay. Give me a second to download them.
Okay. And while he's doing that, I did want to mention, are we at the 11th anniversary of Katrina?
I think I heard that.
I think it was maybe, was it yesterday? Was it Monday? I just want to mention that.
Yes, I think you're right. I think it was yesterday. Let me just make sure, because that is very, very important to remember the victims of Hurricane Katrina. And I think you are right, sir. I think it was as of August 28th, peak strength, 2005. So you are accurate.
All right, I got them downloaded. So just say when.
Yeah, today is the 30th, and the storm lasted from August 23rd, 2005, all the way to August 31st, 2005, where it dissipated. So yes, we are within that realm of the time frame of the storm known as Hurricane Katrina. So yes, to all the victims that lost their lives, and to the people that was displaced, the victims of racism that was displaced and that are continually to be mistreated from the landmass that they do call New Orleans, I do feel a certain kinship because I do have relatives in that particular region. So yes, definitely, to all the victims that lost their lives. They say that it was, 1,000 to 2,000 people lost their lives, but of course we know, per the ones that are still missing, that it's probably more like 5,000 to 6,000 lives lost. So I don't believe that number, not by a little bit. So if you want, we can go ahead and queue up that next clip so we can kind of make sure that we get some of these in before we have to.
Yeah, these ones, they're all pretty short. But the first one, I think, is Chris Hayes, Trump alt-right.
Alt-right is short for alternative right. The Wall Street Journal describes it as a loose but organized movement, mostly online, that rejects mainstream conservatism, promotes nationalism, and views immigration and multiculturalism as threats to white identity. So the de facto merger between Breitbart and the Trump campaign represents a landmark achievement for this group, a fringe element that has effectively taken over the Republican Party.
If you follow the campaign closely, or if you spend a lot of time on Twitter or Reddit, there's a good chance you've encountered alt-right trolls smearing minority groups or sharing sexist memes. Many of them read or write for Breitbart News, whose erstwhile chairman, Steve Bannon, is now in charge of the Trump campaign as its CEO. We are the platform for the alt-right, Bannon proudly told Mother Jones of Breitbart last month. In her speech today, Hillary Clinton read a few choice headlines that have appeared on the site.
Birth control makes women unattractive and crazy. Would you rather your child had feminism or cancer? Gabby Giffords, the gun control movement's human shield. Hoisted high and proud, the Confederate flag proclaims a glorious heritage. Just imagine Donald Trump reading that and thinking, this is what I need more of in my campaign.
Breitbart's best-known provocateur, the author of some of those headlines, is a pretty despicable guy named Milo Yiannopoulos, who was permanently barred from Twitter in July for instigating a campaign of online abuse against comedian Leslie Jones. Jones, Saturday Night Live cast member who starred in the recent Ghostbusters reboot, received a torrent of outrageously racist and repugnant messages on Twitter. Today, a month later, the Department of Homeland Security announced it's investigating a hack of her website, where hackers posted personal information, including her passport, as well as explicit photos of her. Clinton sent Jones a signed personal tweet this afternoon. Les Dog, no one deserves this, least of all someone who brings us so much joy. I'm with you, H. Alt-right Twitter has also targeted Jewish journalists for harassment, especially those covering the Trump campaign. After writing a profile of Melania Trump for GQ, which Trump later claimed contained numerous inaccuracies, reporter Julia Yaffe was inundated with threatening anti-Semitic messages, many of them invoking the Holocaust, ultimately prompting her to file a police report. Joining me now, NBC News political reporter Benji Sarlin, who's covered this movement. Julia Yaffe, now contributing writer at Politico Magazine. Julia, I got to start because the episode that you encountered was mentioned by Secretary Clinton. Take a listen.
When Trump was asked about anti-Semitic slurs and death threats coming from his supporters, he refused to condemn them.
Julie, I think the key part here is that we are talking about people that run a range of views that are generally white supremacist or Nazi in inclination, anti-Semitic explicitly. But there's this kind of like pack horde trolling enterprise that they can engage in online that if you live a lot of your time online, as you do, can be just, it's massively disturbing. It's not like some thing remotely some people are writing. It's they're actually coming after you.
Well, in my case, and I think as was the case for a lot of journalists, not just Jewish ones, is, you get one tweet, then you get five tweets. There's kind of like a geometric element to it where they just multiply and you turn away from your Twitter feed and a moment later there's 100 more of them and 1,000 of them and you just have to walk away, otherwise it takes over your whole life. In my case, it also crossed over into reality where I was getting, somebody had posted my phone number online, so I was getting threatening phone calls, people saying I had ordered a coffin or a homicide cleanup to my apartment. So at that point, it had kind of crossed into the realm of the more real than just somebody maybe sitting in their mother's basement, as the meme goes, and pounding out these tweets at me.
And I just want to play this because I think one of the questions today is about this sort of like association, right? Guilt by association. Obviously, Steve Bannon actually works for the campaign. Donald Trump himself has retweeted the account White Genocide on numerous occasions. But here's Trump actually being asked about what happened to you. Take a listen.
Some of your supporters have viciously attacked this woman, Julia Yaffe, with anti-Semitic attacks, death threats. These people get so angry. What's your message to these people when something like that happens?
I haven't read the article, but I heard it was a very inaccurate article. They shouldn't be doing that with wives. I mean, they shouldn't be doing that. Melania, as a top model, they sent pictures around to Utah, and
these anti-Semitic.
Oh, I don't know about that. I don't know anything about
but,
that.
But your message
fans of mine.
Supposed fans of yours posting these very angry.
You'll have to talk to them.
But your message to these fans is.
I don't have a message to the fans.
Benji, this to me is the key, is that from the beginning, there has been this cluster of people with very, very, frankly, vile and fringe views that Donald Trump has quite knowingly played essentially footsie with.
Exactly, and this is where he really has separated himself. You know, these elements have existed for a long time.
Right.
As Hillary Clinton alluded to in her speech, they've had different names, different manifestations, but there've always been this kind of white nationalist front, and one of their biggest tactics was to try to show up at mainstream conservative settings and basically dare people to get rid of them. So at CPAC, for example, sometimes some of these same people, these white nationalist figures, would sort of show up and infiltrate. And then eventually they wind up and, leaders would end up denouncing them. Trump's thing is that he doesn't denounce anyone who supports him almost ever, with rare occasions when he's really pushed into it, like with David Duke and the KKK, and even then he was sort of waffling.
It took him a long time.
Right, so you end up with a situation where, whether it's because he really, really wants the support of these people or agrees with them, I mean, obviously there's elements of his campaign that hook up with things they like, he doesn't like saying no to anyone who's saying nice things about him, ever. And you just end up with him, blindly retweeting praise from people like White Genocide or white supremacist memes with hoax statistics accusing, blacks of murdering whites at astronomical rates.
Yeah, and Julia, this, I mean, the other thing I think that's key here is that, like, one of the really disturbing elements, having covered American politics for, you know, a decade or around there, you know, I have never encountered just sort of outright Nazis much in covering American politics until this campaign, until dealing with this corner of the alt-right online Trump world where people have Hitler mustaches and talk about ovens. And I mean, the most vile views in the world suddenly are just like not that many degrees of separation from the nominee of the party.
Well, and you have a situation, you know, I found myself listening to Secretary Clinton's speech and thinking, like, this is where we've come to, that the alt-right, that these people who, I think for a long time, a lot of us journalists who receive these attacks would say, like, oh, whatever, you know, we don't know who these people are, how many of them there are, just some pathetic loser in his basement, right, tweeting at me, who cares? But we've gotten to a point where the Democratic presidential nominee has whole speech addressed to them. I mean, talk about going mainstream. That's about as mainstream as it gets.
Do you think, I asked McKay this question, having covered this, I mean, it is probably a good day for Breitbart, right? I mean, I've said it, you know, I haven't said that.
It's an awesome day.
And for White Genocide TM.
And for White Genocide TM.
Every single one of these people individually are celebrating. I mean, this is their big break.
But here's the thing. They will not be able to stop themselves from responding. I mean, that's part of what this is. Right, of course, but the point is that the degree to which you bait them to come out and talk is sort of precisely, it seems to me, part of what the Clinton camp is doing.
Yeah, I mean, this seems to be in many ways a tactical move on both sides. One is that, you know, it's tough for Trump to renounce any supporters. So if he gets asked about some of these incidents individually, some of these people individually, it puts him in a difficult spot. But the other thing is that these people have been dying for their big spotlight. They're, right. You know, suddenly we have TV producers saying, who can we get from this movement? We need someone to represent
them. Is White Genocide booked? Does anyone have the contact info for White Genocide?
So suddenly the Trump campaign will have to deal with whatever they say on air. And it ends up in a very difficult situation.
That support Mr. Trump and Mike Pence's ideas.
It's very cute, right? It's sweet. It's like a nice little grace note. However chaotic and disorganized and occasionally nonsensical the Trump campaign can sometimes be, you can get good press, and there are still cute, heartwarming stories out there, like a Kids for Trump group forming in Colorado. That was 2.5 weeks ago on the local news in Colorado. If you want to get a sense of just how well the Trump campaign is operating in a crucial state like Colorado, consider that today, that 12-year-old boy who was the subject of that heartwarming local news story about his enthusiasm for Donald Trump 2.5 weeks ago, that 12-year-old boy today is no longer just running Kids for Trump, which is admittedly adorable. He is now running Jefferson County, Colorado, for the Donald Trump campaign. One of the most populous counties in the state. It includes part of the Denver metro area. The co-chair of the Donald Trump campaign in that major critical part of swing state Colorado is a 12-year-old boy.
Hey, Jefferson, I'm good. You?
In one of the most important elections of our lifetime.
I understand you signed up to volunteer for the Trump campaign.
In one of the most important counties in the state.
Mom.
The Donald Trump campaign is relying on 12-year-old Weston Eimer.
I am the co-chair for the Jefferson County Trump campaign.
You know, it may be that the Kids for Trump kid is a political savant, and it makes total sense to have a 12-year-old boy running the presidential campaign for one of the two major party candidates in one of the most populous counties in a swing state. It may also be that the Trump campaign is a little weird. And that's a weird decision. But having been through 3 complete changes in campaign leadership in 5 months, with campaign filing showing that financially and organizationally, they're running something that looks more like a nationally touring cover band than a presidential campaign, with a 12-year-old in charge of one of the most populous counties in one of the swing states in the country, and even if the reason no one is supposed to worry about all that stuff is because the Republican Party is going to come in and run this campaign ultimately, and the candidate himself isn't really going to be running anything at all once it really counts, even if the Republican Party is supposed to swoop in and take care of all this, how do you factor into that the prospect that the Republican Party might not be welcome doing that, even if they try to come in and take over? Because with the latest changes that have just happened, that is a distinct possibility, and that story is straight ahead tonight. Stay with us.
All right, we're back. So, Mr. DC, did you have any opinions on that? And before you start, that's going to be the last clip that we run, because I want you to talk about Nat Turner and Nate Parker and finish out with that. So,
Man, we don't have the time, but but you know, I really do appreciate you for ending that clip by playing my friend. Oh boy, you know, the only thing that kind of comes up in my mind with all of that, mm-hmm. is that not all white people. See, this goes back to kind of deciphering code, and everybody can kind of get their own code and break code and do your own thing, and you have that right. But what I just heard was not all white people, and the one thing they just kept going through my mind is that they're talking about these groups like they're separate from them. Exactly. Like they're not related to these people. These are not your parents. This is not your cousins, your brothers. We are like white people are not related to nobody. Like, this is ludicrous. And they extend us and collectively make us one group, right? But then, you know, of course, all black people know someone that's been shot, this and that other, been in jail. So this off-right thing, this alternative right, or whatever you want to call it, this confusion, you know, I understand the whole term. I think that it's going to cause more confusion. It appears to be something that's used to hide more, not codified, more, what is the term that I'm looking for when someone basically becomes a little bit more covert in their racism? Somebody that's more refined. Their racism is more refined, and that leads me to the one I love, Rachel Meadow. Just her, just this shadow boxing. She is extraordinary. Like really, the talent that this woman has to be able to just hit points and kind of come at it directly, and then bob and weave on you, and you really feel like you have a friend, but she haven't said one thing about black people. She's not trying to help out black people. She's not trying to extend a hand on trying to solve problems for black people. I mean, it's just Chris Hayes, you know, I could see why he confused a little bit more. He's a little bit more confusing because he hits you with the empathy line, and then he kind of goes and call these people racist, white supremacists. So they attribute this word like these white people are somewhere way over here, and that we don't have anything to do with these particular white people. And we just basically already listed someone that's a senator. Now, I know senators talk to media people all the time. And if this person is a senator, of course they got families. And then these people got families, and of course they're around white people that's all around the United States and all around the globe. It's just this whole deal about trying to separate whiteness and attribute
they're
it to
they're all related.
That's what I'm saying. You can't run a system like this without having it being something that is a group phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, I think
it's just something that we have to pay attention to. Like, we can't be, and this is just a suggestion. This is something that I would just attribute to pay close attention when somebody's trying to divert your attention somewhere else, mm-hmm. especially when they're speaking about a group that's classified as white and they're part of that particular group. Telling you, oh no, don't look over here, look over there, look over there. These are the people, these are the bad people, these are the people that are most powerful. Mm-hmm. Now just think about that for a second. Think about that. They're pointing to somebody saying that they're the most powerful. That's all.
Wow. I want you to touch on, you pretty much handled that. I don't need to really comment too much. Just the point of me getting those clips was really just to listen to the words they're using, how they're speaking about everybody else, not themselves. And that's right. One thing that liberals, you got to listen to them very, very hard. You know, the rights, they're very straightforward, very honest, in my opinion. They just tell it the way they feel about it, and they still are somewhat refined, but they're pretty direct. The liberals, though, man, it's rough, because, you know, it's a reason why we all are the ones who vote. That's why they are, or all of us are more liberal in this country, even though most of us are religious, which is why, you know, there's something off with that anyway. But I think it's treatment is a part of that. But anyway, not to go down that conversation, but I did want you to touch on that real quick, if you don't mind. I know we can probably go into it next program, but before you do that, let me give you two quick news things that I came across. Uh-huh. And you can jump into that. One was just a teenage girl, I think, down in Arizona, who had the Black Lives Matter shirt on, and they made her take it off. In the same school, she had stated that you had kids wearing gay flag shirts and also wearing Confederate flags. And so, of course, after she pointed that out, after the fact, now they want to ban everything, specifically the Confederate flag, but they've been wearing it for who knows, decades. And the one other clip that I came across was a guy who got 45 years, I think 34 years of that was killing a police dog that attacked him.
I think he was
burglarizing somewhere and ended up killing the dog. But I just wanted to mention those two clips because I think that those are somewhat recent.
Those are very recent
that I came across. But anyway, if you can touch on, go ahead and if you can go into that conversation about Nat Turner, so
yeah,
and manhood.
Well, you put me on the spot. Real quick about the victim of racism, Nate Parker, and the extension of Nat Turner. There seems to be this correlation where. How can I go at this? Let me say this. Let me just be honest, and I want to open this as a open opportunity. We may need to do a whole program on this. And I know that you know we're very, very concerned because we don't like speaking, especially when it comes down to our counterpart, Black women. We love Black women. We are supporters of Black women. We have a complete understanding that you are the most mistreated group of women on the planet. That's been proven. So with that being said, some of the things that my observations about this whole case may come off what you were so-called in the circles that I've seen online they probably would consider misogynistic, but please just feel my vibration and understand that I am a person that have a Black mother, I have Black sisters, I have Black women in my family that I love very, very dearly. So with that being said, the situation with Nate Parker, understanding that he was a wrestler on the Penn State wrestling team, he was 19 years old. 19 years old. If I'm not mistaken, I've been to college. I've been a college athlete. We do very, very stupid, immature things. One thing about someone that I know that violates in that way, as far as women are concerned, there's a pattern, which typically leads to multiple women saying the same thing. And you can kind of interject whenever you want to, Paradox. Normally, when someone says that they've been that you're dealing with someone that is a violation or somebody that is a rapist, that term, they normally have a record behind them, and it can start as early as high school, junior high, whatever, you know, whenever it starts. Not to say that you don't have people that violate one time and one time only, and to say that what happened between him and his young lady, the woman that you know tragically took her life, saying that what happened during that time frame wasn't a violation. But what I will say is, knowing that there was a lot of drinking that night, they were 19 years old, Nate Parker is a black male, he was previously involved with this white woman. I know people don't feel like that power dynamic is not the other way, but it is. Clearly, this woman was someone that was sexually involved with Nate Parker previously. That does not excuse what took place in that room, or what they did to coerce her into doing sexual acts. But the little bit, I didn't read all of the transcripts, but the little bit that I did read with the transcripts kind of falls in line on what I thought happened anyway. I think it was most likely something of coercion. I don't think that he's the you know, I think that there's no way to get to the truth of this matter, especially when you're dealing with a foggy situation with people being drunk and then sex is involved, especially with people that are dealing with each other at that level at a very, very young age. It's very, very tedious. But how does this stretch out to Nat Turner? Nat Turner, we talked about it earlier, was a pastor, a reverend of the clergy, someone that decided that that there had to be a maximum violent response to the racist system that he lived in during the time frame of slavery. He organized the slaves to revolt, and they had every right to revolt violently at that particular time. As far as being mistreated, there was no way out, and he ended up killing women, children, and men, and went on a rampage. It didn't matter. All white people were classified as the enemy. What am I trying to say here? There seems to be a mindset that we have as victims where we do not look at this thing in the same veil as what has been happening to us. People use the terms all the time that war has been declared against us. I don't think that people understand what warfare entails. There's all kinds of warfare. There's psychological warfare. There's sexual warfare. There's deception. There's mental manipulation. But at the end of the day, the most effective warfare is when you take life, because when you take life, it does things twofold. If you have people that are left behind, the progeny sees that, and then they basically attribute to the trauma that has taken place. So the reason why I think that this particular film needs to be put on the back burner, or that the reason why they need to give an example of the person that made this film and kind of put it in the context of someone that is doing things illegally, is that I think that the stretch of it being a black male, and if I'm not mistaken, I think he produced, co-wrote, and wrote the screenplay, that is, and acted, is the lead actor, and basically did the whole screenplay. So he handled this film. It's his baby. It's from the nuts to the bolts. And to have this film represent black manhood, I don't use manhood a lot, but with Nat Turner, he wanted to exude black manhood. He made a stand. and said, well, no, this is where it ends. We will respond in kind, and we would do the same things that you have done to us. And we would do it in the same capacity. We will respond in kind. And it still would not make up for all the mistreatment that we have experienced, not just globally, but here in the so-called United States. So with that being intel, I just wanted to give an idea, a little tease about the correlation. Now, hopefully people that's listening to this, they understood exactly what I was saying about the correlation, that is not just about Nate Parker and the rape case, and that it basically could be strategically used. We know that white people practice racism on a regular basis, and they don't care about rape. This whole culture is about rape and violating women across the board. And for them to put a face on that violation on someone when the case clearly dictates that if you read the transcripts, you understand that you cannot prosecute that case. Like, this is not the same thing as that Stanford white male kid that raped that woman behind a dumpster that had two people evidence that saw that. There's no way that that's the same thing that happened here, where there's two people that know each other, they got drunk, they're 19, 20 years old, they go back to the room, he has a friend, they go and have sex with this woman, a female, and then at the end of the day, they violated, she feels violated, he feels like he didn't do anything wrong, and things get foggy. That's not the same thing. So, that's basically my two cents on that. Paradox, if you wanted to share a little quick sum, I think that we do need to go into a program and maybe go into further detail, but that was some of my synopsis on it.
You're I know that you did a little bit of research on that, but you said a mouthful, so I don't really have a lot to say on it. Like I said before, I would love to get one of our black women counterparts on here.
Absolutely. We need to work on that.
So we'll bring them on and have a deeper discussion about race and
consent
and the black family, etc. But we got a few minutes left, and so I want to finish out with this clip from Mr. Fuller, and then that'll pretty much end the program. So do you have any quick thoughts before we close out?
No, the only thing is, hopefully, I know this program has been very, very clip specific, and hopefully we have been able to share some of our views on different things, and hopefully we can come through and kind of like give you a little bit more of our perspective. But we wanted to kind of give you a lot of the ideas about, you know, what white people are thinking, what white people are saying, that actually has an effect on us on a daily basis. And stay codified, and the problem is white people. The problem is white people.
All right, and you can reach us at code_breakers1865 on Instagram. You can email us at codebreakers@1999@gmail.com, and we can also be found on Twitter at codebreakers 191, and of course on Black Talk Radio. And we will be on at this point on the first and third Tuesdays from 9 to 11 every month.
You can also find us on Stitcher Radio and also on TuneIn Radio. Is that correct, Mr. Reed? I want to make sure we...
iTunes.
Yes, the podcasts are available. So share those podcasts with other people that you think could use the information or would benefit from the information.
And hopefully it be constructive. Yes, sir, we will do. And we want to go ahead and end out with a clip, and hopefully this will be clear information. And until next time, I'm D.
This is Paradox.
And we are the Code Breakers. Until next time.
The five basic words to describe what needs to be done. Well, when you put it in the frame of reference, everyone, when they talk about racism and our white supremacists, should always start by saying that the focus, the objective should be replace white supremacy mm-hmm. with justice. Those are the five basic words. And you start your frame of reference from that. The words are very important because when people talk about racism, they tend to get away from the basic focus. If you keep those five words in mind, replace white supremacy with justice, then you can keep focus. In many of these discussions on the matter, people tend to get into everything from feminism to words that don't have precise
communism
definitions.
And everything else, they go off on a tangent.
Yes, right.
Yeah, but this kind of locks it in.
Right, bigotry, discrimination, sexism, a multitude of isms, biracialism, whatever that means, multiculturalism.
Whatever that means.
Yes, and so you get into a myriad of words mm-hmm. that don't apply to the focus of what you're talking about. So therefore, that is the basic frame of reference that you should always focus on. That should be used by all people who are talking about the problem as it is.
What is a tragic arrangement, or the three T's, if you will, and what are some of the first two things that must be done to establish quality relationship between white and non-white people, if you will?
Well, the three T's called a tragic arrangement are tacky, trashy, terroristic. Now, this is the arrangement that non-white people on this planet have with white people in their everyday interactions in all areas of activity.
Tacky, trashy,
and terroristic. One of the three. It doesn't get any better than tacky. If you will observe black people, for instance, in the presence of white people, on account of the way that both of them are raised within the system of white supremacy, there is a strain there. There is not a even flow. Okay. So what you have is a tackiness. It doesn't get any better than tacky. It can't get any better than tacky within the system of white supremacy.
Why?
So this is all very tragic. Well, because the system of white supremacy demands that white people interact with non-white people in a certain way that is harmful and harsh and overall destructive. And that the non-white people interact with the white people in the same manner. And they are taught this. Both people
are taught this.
Are taught this at a very early age, and then the teaching goes on every day in all nine areas of activity: economics, education, entertainment, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war.
All areas of people activity.
All of the areas of people activity.
You know,
everywhere in the known universe.
You know, I noticed something. I used to work with a gentleman, elderly gentleman, and whenever he would come in contact with white people, he always had a tendency to have to be the entertainment committee to make everybody laugh. If we were on the elevator or doing something in the building, he was always the person to make white people laugh. He was always the clown.
Yes.
I always kept a straight face, so he thought something was wrong with me.
Yes, well, you can tell that there's a strain even on college campuses and whatnot and in schools. The people will go to the classes together because that's where the classes are. That's where the teaching is. And then the students will separate themselves in the lunchroom. Now, there's a reason for that. And the reason is not healthy. It shows that something is completely, completely out of order. Because if the people are sharing the same classroom and learning the same things and having the same values that are taught in that classroom, then why do not the people interact with each other in all of the areas of activity without exception in harmony?
Well, maybe they're not learning the same thing.
That is it.
Maybe they taught the same thing, but
yes,
not necessarily
learning the same thing. That is it. Under the system of white supremacy, a black student sitting next to a white student is being taught how to be a victim of white supremacy. The white person, the white student, is being taught how to be a white supremacist.
And it's all in
this
the language.
This is done in the language, in the use of the words, in the subject matter of the materials. If the material in any way relates to interactions between people. Now, the other three, two T's, trashy, if you try to improve on the tackiness, then it gets trashy.
Meaning
the interactions
what?
Between. For instance, you can say that in the area of religion, Sunday morning, black people and white people do not attend the same churches.
Dr. King says the most segregated hour in America.
Right. Now, that is tacky, particularly in the area of religion. It should not be. The two people should come together in religion if in nothing else, it would seem logically speaking. But under the system of racism, since the basic teaching of the white supremacy system is that white supremacy is a religion, so you have a built-in barrier
already
against black people and white people sharing the same premises and preaching the same gospel and talking about loving each other and treating each other with justice. So therefore, you can't have what you call black people and white people in the same religious setting, which is why you don't have it.
So,
you do have, and I'd like to add this, is the trashiness that goes on the same Sunday morning, and that is maybe in the houses of prostitution, in the houses of dope dealing. Then you will have black and white together.
That's the only
same day,
place.
On Sunday.
Wow, that's interesting that you would say that, because you have these two groups, and we both say we're Christians. We have white Baptists, then we have black Baptists, and we're supposed to be worshiping the same God, if
yes,
you will.
One in Christ, they often say. And that is something that not even many black people care to explain, that they say we are, you know, in Christ there is no east, no west, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yet, the black people and the white people cannot sit down in the same bench in a church.
I find it interesting, speaking of religion, that you could have Billy Graham come to town and all the black ministers start bowing down. Minister Louis Farrakhan comes and there's controversy.
Well, that is because of the race issue.
As well.
It's always because of the race issue. You can't do anything. You can't straighten out anything in religion or any of the nine areas of activity without first eliminating racism. And here again, there's only one functional form, and that is white supremacy.
What should be used as a role model for replacing white supremacy?
The role model for replacing white supremacy should be a code of thought, speech, and action, not a person, never a person. And that's also applies to producing justice throughout the world, which justice has never been produced, as far as anyone who is existing now knows anything about. We don't know what justice would be like. We don't know what peace would be like.
Yes.
Never had it. So in the process of producing justice, you need a role model, and that role model has to be a prescription. Some ministers have said in the beginning there was the word. Now that certainly applies also to straightening out race problems. You have to have the words. The words are not correct. Hardly any of the words are correct. The words are designed to support racism. And this is why you have the confusion you have in the schools.
Deceit.
Yes, the deceit. See, the words are designed to support deceit, which is the basic tool of the white supremacists.